And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we're coming at you live like every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. If you're listening live, you can join us in the chat room at podcastufo.com. I want to address last week, we had to put up a pre-recorded show. We had a bunch of technical difficulties, and Whitley Strieber was on the line. He said he could only be on for a half hour anyway, so it all kind of worked out, but I'm not sure if Whitley will be back with us or not. So tonight, we have another great guest. We have Bruce Maccabee, and he's going to be talking about his new book, The FBI-CIA UFO Connection, The Hidden UFO Activities of the USA Intelligence Agencies. Interesting topic. And for right now, though, we have back with us Alejandro Rojas, and he's going to discuss the UFO news. How you doing, Alejandro?
Hello, doing good. How are you?
Great. Good to be back. So what's going on with the UFO news this week?
Yeah, so we got some stuff to catch up on, and this is a real big one that's gone on in the last few weeks. This is something that John Greenwald of theblackvault.com did. Hopefully, you've probably had him on the show. If not, you should, because he, of course, holds this database of probably the most files recovered via FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act. And there's a big deal around NSA UFO documents. And he essentially tried to get more information on them recently, and they said they lost them all. And this is a big deal, because what happened is, in the late 70s, a group called Citizens Against UFO Secrecy petitioned to get, they used FOIA to get a bunch of UFO files from different government agencies, one of them being the NSA. NSA said no. They sued them. So the head of this group was Peter Gersten, who's a lawyer. He sued the NSA. The NSA said, well, here, they wrote a 20-page document to the judge saying, here's why we don't want to release UFO documents. The judge then said, you know what, we agree with you that it's too much of a danger to the national security to release these, so we're going to keep them secret. That 21-page document then was also classified. Soon after this happened, though, it did get declassified, but it was heavily redacted, all blacked out. And Stanton Friedman uses this a lot when he goes and he does lectures and he shows a page of all that where you can only see a sentence or two and everything else is blacked out with marker. And everybody always, you know, gets a big kick out of that. And it demonstrates very well that there is government secrecy around this stuff. Well, what this document justified to the judge was that, you know, we don't need to release these 156 communication documents that refer to UFOs, and the NSA, not that they investigated UFOs, but they collect communications between foreign governments, and that's what these were. Finally, years later in the 90s, when it became more difficult to keep documents that were over 25 years old classified, they released these 156 documents. However, these two were heavily, heavily redacted, but they got a little smarter. They must have seen Stanton Friedman's talks. Mm. And instead of just blacking out, they also whited out most of it. So it doesn't look as interesting on television. You know, it doesn't make as bold of a statement when everything's back. Instead, it's all whited out. And that's the state these documents have been in. So what John Greenwald did was try to get more of that information unredacted. And this is similar to what the group did with the CIA documents when they got Area 51 unredacted recently, you know, about a year ago. So we all know Area 51's there and it's official. They told him that, well, here's the Yates affidavit. Here's the document to the judge, that 21-page document, more unredacted. However, we lost those 156 UFO documents, which is very tragic because they look like some incredible cases that the NSA had plugged into. And, of course, many people are questioning, did they really lose these documents? Right. I mean, there's a website the NSA as for UFO files. These are obviously very important to the public, and the public has been asking about these documents for years, and they didn't hold on to them or keep them safe, and they lost them. So I think this story is a big deal.
I think so, too. And, you know, come on. They didn't lose them. I can't believe that that could possibly happen. And by the way, John Greenwald will be on the show at some point. He has he and I have been communicating for quite a while. He's a very busy life, new baby and all that stuff, as he says. But hopefully we'll have him on. That is really an amazing story that that they actually admit that they lost these. And, yeah, you're right. You look at those papers, and there's like one sentence every paragraph possibly. You know, it's really ridiculous.
If that, it is really ridiculous. You can't make anything out. And when you go through these files, some of them look like they might be really interesting UFO cases.
Yeah, and probably lost forever now. So, oh well.
Yeah, pretty sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. What can you do?
What can you do, right? So what else is happening?
So what else? This is kind of cool. Well, I'm excited about this because this is a guy that we had interviewed, William Hopp. He wrote a script for a first person, you know, found footage abduction movie. So and, you know, we're all thinking big deal. We've seen that before. But he based it off of actual abductees' experiences, which is really important because, as you know, a lot of these movies are just made up, you know, and they turn out, at least to me, to be major disappointments. So, for instance, what happened to Travis Walton on The Craft or Fourth Kind, they're terrible. But this one, he really wants to stick to what really happens. And he says, for that reason, he's gone to crowdfunding, and he doesn't want to have investors that are going to mess it up. And when I interviewed him, that was the stage he was at. He was looking to get some funds. And it was like, I wanted to interview him because it was cool that he had this fascination and this goal. But I was even skeptical he would get anywhere. But now he's released a press release. He's been working on this. He has an Emmy Award-winning partner. She's been a director on the TV show Intervention. He's got some Hollywood actors. And they're going to start shooting on October 1st. So he's really going to make this happen. And I'm really excited about it because his intention with this movie is to bring the topic to the forefront, show the public what happens and what these people are reporting, and to also use this to kind of create an abductee support kind of organization across the country. Wow. So
that's great.
Now, it's kind of cool. I think it's a neat thing.
Yeah. Now, I do remember getting something from him. He was doing a Kickstarter or something.
Correct. Yep, he was doing the Kickstarter. And he says, you know, when Hollywood types get involved, they just want to make it all cookie cutter and change things. And so he wanted to avoid that, to be able to stick to the truth.
Great. Wow.
Excellent. Yeah, really cool.
We have one more story tonight?
I do. I've got one more, and this is regarding hoaxes, one of your favorite topics. I noticed you posted one earlier today.
I did. Yep.
It's hard not to, and this is what happened with this sighting in Portsmouth and in England, where this guy tweets this picture and says it's a UFO he saw, and he tweeted it around. He made a hashtag, Pompey UFO, because I guess Pompey is nickname for Portsmouth. And so people started talking about it. People were like, yeah, I think I've seen something like this. It hit the news, and it made news all over the place. And then he came out and said, oh, just kidding. You know, that was just a hoax, and I'm actually just trying to promote this event get-together that these guys are having. And I think it even has to do with, like, the movie Back to the Future or something like that.
Now, if you look at the picture, it looks like a lenticular cloud, which I see all the time.
Lenticular clouds are typically created over mountains. Well, I guess that's where they are created. And so this one is kind of out in the middle of nowhere, which is a little stranger than usual. But it is like, yeah, it looks like a little cloud that's very interesting shaped. It's shaped like a disc. And maybe he took that and just decided to run with it because he knew people would think it was cool. But, actually, it looks like I forgot now that I'm looking at the story. He shows the original picture where the cloudy UFO thing's not in it. So he photoshopped that in there. And that's what's hard is these people think they're being cute and they think they're not hurting anybody when they do this. Like in Canada, this happened a year or so ago where this planetarium hoaxed people and made some news. And it's frustrating. Right. And
at the ball game or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. You know, I want to talk quickly about the thing I posted this afternoon that you looked at. And that was another hoax. And when I first saw that, that was actually on someone on that's a friend of mine on Facebook had it posted. And it's Latin American or something. I don't know exactly. But I first looked at that and I went, wow, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And but right away, you know, Mark D'Antonio said he's already researched that one. It's 100% CGI. And boy, I'll tell you, that does make me upset.
Because it does. And it's really hard, you know, and that's why before I get excited about anything, and most people can't do this. Luckily, it's my job, but you have to do so much research to find out where it came from. Is it like anything else? And sometimes you can do a lot of research and feel pretty good about it, and then you find out later, you know, that someone else, you know, that you find out evidence that it's a hoax, and what can you do?
That's right. Well, hey, thanks so much, Alejandro. Good to have you back. Good to be back myself as well.
All right. Yep. Good to be talking to you, and we'll talk to you next week.
See you next week. All right. Now, stay tuned, and we'll be right back after the short music break with Bruce McAbee. Dr. Bruce McAbee, how are you?
I am fine, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining the show. This is the second time you've been on, and we're going to be talking about your new book. And if you would, can you just go into the title and a little quick synopsis of that?
This book is called The FBI-CIA UFO Connection. It's in three parts. One is the FBI section, the real X-Files. The second part is what the CIA was doing in the early years. And the third part recounts my own direct experiences with the CIA. Unlike most people in the field of ufology who suspect the CIA may be doing something, I was able to actually, because they penetrate the secrecy by virtue of a sort of an accidental situation regarding my Navy work. I used to work for the U.S. Navy doing physics research, and as a result of that, I did some research on a topic called laser-generated underwater sound, LGUS. And it turned out that there was a CIA guy who was interested in the same subject, not only that, but he happened to be the holder of the weird desk at the CIA. So I can get more into that in depth, but that sort of summarizes the substance of the book, topically speaking. The first part of the book is a almost a linear history of the subject in the early days. I've often thought if we knew what happened during the first 5 years of the subject, we'd know 90% of the whatever is going on, why it's going on, and so on. But the only thing that is really different from the early 50s was the onset of abduction stuff. Primarily in the 1970s. There have been some abduction reports earlier than the 1970s, but that's when they began to become numerous abduction stories. You already mentioned one on Travis Walton in 1975. Mm-hmm. And then when Bud Hopkins' book came out, Missing Time, 1980, that was sort of a paradigm shift right there. There was suddenly a theory for why these things were happening. The third part of my book has to do with CIA interest in UFOs. They had been interested in the early 50s, along with the FBI. Now, the book combines the Air Force, the FBI, the CIA, and the Air Force Intelligence. Air Force Intelligence was sort of responsible for collecting reports and figuring out what was going on with the flying saucer sightings that were being reported all over the United States. And they brought in the FBI in July of 1947 to help investigate witnesses. This whole subject sort of started in June 24th, 1947, with Kenneth Arnold's sighting. And then a couple of weeks after that was Roswell, but Roswell got buried immediately.
Hmm.
There was also sightings at Muroc Air Force Base, which is now Edwards Air Force Base, sightings by Air Force people. At that point, the Air Force couldn't ignore what was going on. And on the 10th of July, a general in charge of intelligence collection, General George A. Shulgin, contacted the FBI and asked for help in investigating. Shulgin promised the FBI full cooperation with the Air Force, and there was exchanging information. And he said that the Air Force had interviewed a pilot who had seen one of these things, along with a psychologist, and under intense interviewing, the guy stuck to his story. And so they were thinking that they're investigating the possibility there was some new natural phenomenon or somebody was actually flying solid craft around, and that would be the Soviets. So they brought in the FBI ostensibly to check on individual witnesses and see if any of them were Soviet sympathizers. The possibility that was considered was that there might be Soviet sympathizers generating spurious, non-existent flying saucer reports in order to convince the American people that the Soviets could fly with impunity some strange craft around. And the American people, they better watch out and not mess around with the Soviet Union, because they had better, more capable flying craft or something. Well, the FBI did, in fact, investigate some witnesses. When the TV show X-Files came out, everybody thought that was a big joke. But there was, in fact, a file named Security Matter -X in the FBI. And that's where it sort of the FBI acted like a black hole, receiving information, storing it continuously. It didn't come out at all until 1977 as a result of the Freedom of Information Act request that I made.
Okay. We seem to be having a little bit of difficulty with the connection here. Not sure if you're listening, Keith, but we're having people.
You sound good to me.
Yep. Okay. All right. Well, we'll just keep moving along. And if you're listening live, you can join us in the chat room at podcastufo.com, and you can pose Dr. Bruce McAbee a question if you like. So, Bruce, you. I got your book through Kindle. I just noticed 2 days ago that it was on Kindle, and I just started breezing through it. And there's a lot of fascinating topics and chapters. And, you know, you started way back, was it in the late 70s that you got involved in this, or was it even earlier than that?
It was the late 60s that I became intrigued by the subject, you might say. And I started doing unique, what might be considered unique research, stuff that other people hadn't done. And I started doing that in the early 70s. And in fact, it was one of the first cases that I tackled that was the reason why I got the FBI file in the first place. I was investigating the Trent photographs
of
McMinnville, Oregon, in 1950. And part of the testimony of the Trents, which I was able to talk to Mrs. Trent many times, and I collected the testimony that other people had gotten from the Trents. Part of the testimony was that an FBI guy, or two FBI guys, had visited the Trents within a few weeks of the publication of their pictures. Their pictures were published in June of 1950. And the thing about the Trent pictures is, it's either a real thing or a hoax. Either the real thing or a hoax. There's no halfway point. The images are so large, and they appear in the front of the book because I was told that the FBI had interviewed Mr. Trent, and I was doing an investigation of the whole case, and sometime in 1976, or the fall of 1976, I decided to see if I could get anything out of the FBI with regard to the Trent case. Basically, I wanted to know if they had, in fact, interviewed him. And so I wrote a letter to the FBI under the then relatively new Freedom of Information and Privacy Act, FOIPA, often abbreviated just Freedom of Information Act. Anyway, I wrote to the FBI saying, could you tell me if you have anything on Trent? And, oh, by the way, sort of a second thought, by the way, if you have anything else on UFOs, please let me know. I didn't expect to get anything on UFOs because the only previous mention of the FBI being not involved, really, was by Captain Edward J. Ruppel, who had written the report on unidentified flying objects. He wrote that one in 1954-55. He said the FBI had never been involved, so I didn't expect to get anything. About 8 months later, in May, I think it was, of 1977, while I'm sitting at my desk working, I get a phone call from a very surprised FBI agent who said, not only are there some documents, there's about 1,600 pages of stuff here in the FBI file. And so he sent me a bunch of documents, and he said, oh, by the way, I'm not supposed to say anything, but I'll tell you anyway, we don't have any file on Trent. So I got my Trent answer, and I got a lot more to boot, hundreds of pages of FBI stuff. And it turned out that the FBI acted like almost like a spy on the Air Force. The FBI collected information, which the Air Force gave to the FBI, and stored it at headquarters, and had all that stuff ready. Was what was released in 1977 to me, and some of that was very important, indicating that some stuff that you find in the FBI file that you don't find in the Air Force's file called Project Blue Book. I have to understand, when I refer to the Blue Book file, I talk about what's on a microfilm record, or what used to be a microfilm record, is now on the Internet. It contained the files of a project called SIGN, which was the first known project of the Air Force. I say known because there probably were projects that were unknown and still are. But the first known project was called SIGN, the second known project was called GRUDGE, the third is called Project Blue Book. And all these, the Blue Book file collects all these things together. It also adds in files of the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, which did a lot of the actual case investigation. Well, the FBI file, a part that's of most interest, shows what the Air Force was doing in the first 5 years. And the thing you get from the FBI file you don't get anywhere else is statements that say top Air Force officials were seriously considering interplanetary as an explanation for the flying saucer reports. And you don't hear the Air Force ever saying that publicly or publishing anything. It would imply that they were even considered the interplanetary explanation.
Mm-hmm. Now, you wrote a book back in 2000 or something like that was similar to this, right?
Yes, it was. The big difference between that book and this one, there's two big differences. One is I actually am able to publish documents. The Llewellyn Publishing Company wouldn't let me publish any of the documents that I was talking about. Well, they let me publish two, but I got a whole bunch of them in this. You can scan through your e-book version and find copies of documents that I refer to. And so what you have there is improved and rewritten and expanded version of what I had 14 years ago. Mm-hmm. But also, I've never published my interactions with my direct interactions with the CIA. That's in the third section of this book, and that's totally new.
Yeah, we have some questions coming up on the message board, and the first one right off the bat is kind of a sounds like kind of a controversial question. It's were you removed as chairman of FUFOR, Fund for UFO Research, or did you leave when someone was accusing you of being a mole in the UFO field for the CIA? That's quite a question.
It turned out that I moved away from the area, and it was very difficult for me to travel after I moved into the hills of Maryland. It was difficult for me to travel to meetings. And so basically after being the director of FUFOR for about 13 years, I resigned the directorship. I'm still a member of the National Committee, of course. I can't think of his last name, Todd Zuckel, was angry that the fund didn't support his research, he decided to, for some reason, he decided to get back at me and the fund by claiming that I was a CIA mole, essentially spying on the UFO field on behalf of the CIA, which was not true. I did have CIA connections, and this is written in the book. Turned out that having these CIA connections turned out to be quite advantageous as far as getting information on sightings and stuff was concerned.
Okay. Well, another question just came up. Let's see. Do you have any comment on what official or organization has made the decision to cover up the topic and why they have done so?
Well, I've studied the history way back at the very beginning, and I would say that the cover-up began, whether Roswell was real or not, the Air Force investigators who were studying sightings alone concluded in the summer of 1948 that the best explanation for all these sightings was interplanetary vehicles.
Hmm.
And they were shot down by General Hoyt Vandenberg, who was the Chief of Staff of the Air Force at the time. This is recounted in Edward Ruppelt's book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. What I'm talking about is known as the estimate of the situation.
Right.
The estimate being that they were interplanetary. The estimate was sent up to the chain of command, probably through the Air Materiel chain of command, starting at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, going up to the top general, and he kicked it back for lack of proof. The gentleman from Air Materiel Command went to the Pentagon and talked to Vandenberg directly and couldn't convince him, or he refused to be convinced, whichever way it is, and they went back home with their tails between their legs. Now, they had spent a year studying over 100 UFO sightings, flying saucer sightings, and using the best logic they could. I mean, they arrived at a logical conclusion. These weren't craft made by the United States. They weren't craft made by the Soviet Union. They weren't natural phenomena. They weren't misidentifications, hoaxes, or delusions. They were a subset of the total number of collection, which absolutely could not be explained. And the only, in a conventional manner, the only explanation that made any sense was they were craft made by somebody else from somewhere else. And that was the logical conclusion. Well, Vandenberg, in effect, told him, sorry, wrong answer. He couldn't accept that. And after that, the investigative analysis tended to fall apart. And it's shown in great detail in my book how the Air Force acted sort of like a split personality. On one day, they would say it was Soviet aircraft. On another day, they'd say, well, maybe it's our own secret stuff that we don't know anything about. On a third day, they'd say it was all misidentifications, hoaxes, and delusions. And they'd come up with any explanation at all, even remotely fit a sighting, just to get an explanation. Any explanation in a storm, you might say. And this rejection of the estimate of the situation was one key part, you might say, that formed the coffin for the ET explanation. And then during the summer of 1952, when there were thousands of sightings, at a press conference, General John A. Sanford, the director of Air Force Intelligence, nailed the coffin shut on the ET explanation by saying everything was natural phenomena. Even though the FBI, on the same day as that press conference, the FBI was told that top Air Force officials were seriously considering interplanetary ships. Now, if Sanford had said something about interplanetary ships at that press conference, the lid would have blown off, and there would have been a whole different history to the UFO subject. The idea of interplanetary ships, of course, had been around almost since the beginning of the sightings, but not endorsed at all by the Air Force. And the Air Force always took the attitude that there was no new technology represented by flying saucers and no threat to the United States. And that was supposedly all they were worried about, whether there was new technology and a threat to the United States. And in my book, you can see where the Air Force ignored or gave incorrect explanations for a number of sightings that I said in the book. But the big thing that you get out of this book, you don't get out of most other histories of the book, is histories of the subject, is the duplicity, you might say, of the Air Force and what they told the American people versus what they told the FBI, for example, people on the inside.
Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of weird, you know. I mean, I was breezing through your book, and that the was it the CIA or the FBI that was actually investigating the Air Force investigating UFOs?
The Air Force investigated by interviewing witnesses. The FBI, for a period of time at Hoover's direction, responding to the Air Force requests for help, the agents actually interviewed witnesses for a period of time, and then stopped. I can tell you why, but they stopped interviewing. And the CIA, on the other hand, didn't interview witnesses at all. The CIA interviewed the Air Force, the people at Wright Patterson Air Force Base, Air Technical Intelligence Center. And as far as I can tell, I mean, it appears to me that the Air Force people lied to the CIA. The Air Force people said there was absolutely no possibility of interplanetary ships. And yet we know from the FBI file that there was a possibility, because the FBI was told that by one of the people in the Air Force Intelligence Office, Commander Boyd. But the CIA was told something different, that everything was either natural phenomena, misidentifications of man-made stuff. It wasn't ours, it wasn't Soviet, and it wasn't, definitely wasn't interplanetary.
Mm-hmm.
The CIA got interested anyway because they said, even if people can't identify normal things up in the atmosphere, up in the air, if they file or start reporting flying saucers, whether these are extraterrestrial or not, if they start making reports, they can jam up the communications channels that might be necessary to communicate during a time of attack by the Soviet Union. In other words, if communist sympathizers were to generate a bunch of spurious flying saucer sightings reports at the same time that the Soviets were flying aircraft to the United States to start a war, these aircraft would initially be reported as, quote, unidentified flying objects, because you wouldn't know initially what these things were. So there'd be a mix-up of the spuriously generated reports with actual radar tracking of actual aircraft coming. And that would be detrimental to our own defensive capability if you couldn't tell the difference between a spurious flying saucer report and a report of a Soviet fighter jet or bomber.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, as far as the CIA was concerned, the reports were dangerous. They weren't worried about the flying saucers themselves. The Air Force said there weren't any interplanetary flying saucers. But the reports could be bad if there were a lot of reports came into the communications channels.
Now, there's some questions flying up here and there. And did you ever actually work for the CIA, or did you just, you know, work with them in ways of talking with them and getting information and sharing or whatever?
I worked for the Navy, and as I said at the very beginning, I work on, part of what I work on over the years was this laser-generated underwater sound problem. That's where you have an airplane flying over the ocean, for example, and you have a powerful laser that creates a laser, a pulse of light that comes down and hits the water surface, causes it to evaporate at a high rate, which is essentially creating a small explosion on the surface, and sound goes down into the water. And we were trying to figure out how to use this for anti-submarine warfare and anti-mine warfare. We were doing this work starting in 1973 at the Naval Surface Warfare Center where I worked. In 1984, a CIA guy called me up and wanted to know what we were doing because he had been watching, he had been tracking Soviet research on underwater, generation of underwater sound by lasers. And he found there was a lot of Soviet papers on the subject, and only a couple of open literature Soviet papers on the subject, and only a couple in the what we used to call a free world. So he wondered if we were behind the Soviets in this developing this potentially useful technology, and he found out that I and other a couple other guys at this laboratory were the only people in the United States who were working on the subject, so he called me up one day and wanted me to give a briefing at the CIA headquarters on our work to on this LGUS stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's how I like associated with the CIA began. Over the next 10 years or so, we pursued this LGUS research. And I was, of course, being paid by the Navy all the time, except for one period of time where for a week I was doing experiments with a laser, experiments that the CIA wanted me to do. They paid the Navy and the Navy paid me, so I was the closest I ever got to being employed by the CIA.
Sure. Another question up there, it's a few people want to talk about the Gulf Breeze and what your thoughts were on that whole situation.
Yeah, I've mentioned Gulf Breeze in the book, because that was one of the subjects that I actually gave lectures at the CIA on UFO stuff, several lectures. And this is, again, outlined in the book. And as far as Gulf Breeze is concerned, I'm sure my CIA contact thought the whole thing was a hoax. But as for myself, I started out thinking it was a hoax. The Gulf Breeze complex of sightings, it's not something you can talk about and get very far, in a few minutes. It began on November 11th, 1987, with a series of sightings by people, culminating in photos taken by Ed Walters. And that part of it is in the book. Each one of those important sightings that occurred before Walters even saw the object. And then Ed Walters is probably the person who a lot of people think is the totality of the Gulf Breeze phenomenon. But Walters did have sightings where he took photographs and one video starting in November 1987 and going all the way into July of 1988 is where I sort of the first segment of the Gulf Breeze sightings. Gulf Breeze sightings lasted up until the mid-90s. At a much lower rate, but during the 87-88 time frame, there was a high rate of sightings. In the spring of 1988, there were probably about 100 other witnesses who saw things, and a dozen who claimed they saw the same thing that appeared in Ed's picture, including some very credible witnesses. The county coroner, his wife, on July 10th, 1988, said that they saw the same thing that was in Ed's pictures, flying over the Pensacola Bay, not too far from where they lived. That was how they happened to see it. They were outside and saw this object moving around, and as I said, they testified publicly that it was the same thing that they saw in Ed's photographs. Ed certainly wasn't a model. Now, there's a lot of complexity in this case because you have the sightings that were going on in the starting in November 1987, the MUFON investigators finding out who Ed was in January of 1988 and interviewing him directly, following along what happened on a day-by-day basis, the fact that I got brought in on February 19th, thinking that this whole thing was another Billy Meyer situation, and in this case, I ran into numerous photographs, but also numerous witnesses were testifying to the same thing. The MUFON investigators tracked Ed's activities almost on a day-by-day basis. They were very helpful in collecting information. And then Ed, at my suggestion, made stereo cameras. He was given a small so-called Nimslo camera with four lenses in it and told that this was good. This is when he takes one picture, the four lenses would create four images, and the pictures could be chopped up and sent to various analysts for various professionals for analysis. And he went along with that and took some pictures of a strange type of object that flew by, and he took 10 pictures of it one night. And I analyzed the pictures and turned out that it was an object that was like 40 feet away and a couple of 2.5 feet in size. And this is determined from the fact that you could do a triangulation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he had been accused of creating his pictures by taking a small model, let's say 4 or 5, 6 inches, and doing a double exposure where you go into a dark room, have a lighted object that's the only source of light in the room is the lighting on this object. You take a picture. Now, with his old Polaroid camera, you could click the shutter any number of times before you pulled the film out and started to develop. For those of you who have never seen such a thing, I say this old Polaroid camera had a roll of film and a roll of developer, and you had to put it in the camera just right. When you did that, you took a picture and pulled a paper tab out of the camera, that compressed the negative onto this roll of film, which had a developer on it, and the film would develop in 60 seconds, and then you could take the picture out of the back of the camera as a fully developed photograph. But you could click the shutter any number of times before you pulled the tab out to start the developing. And it turns out that a well-known phenomenon in photography is that the picture on the film is built up from the number of times you click the shutter. So you could take a picture of a model UFO in a dark room and create what would be called a latent image on the film. You don't pull out the tab yet. You go outdoors. You hold the camera in such a way that you have to know where the model is going to appear in the frame of the picture. You go out and take a picture of the background scene, and then you pull a tab, and you get the compound effect of the model image on top of the background image. These things add together, so you can sometimes tell if there's a double exposure going on. Ed had been accused of doing this. Well, he couldn't do it with a Nimslo camera because that was a sealed camera and it didn't use Polaroid film. It was ordinary 35-millimeter film. And then he made, at my suggestion, he made an even bigger stereo camera that used Polaroid cameras, Polaroid Model 600 cameras, that eject the film immediately after you click the button. And he took a stereo picture in particular on May 1, which had two different objects at different distances and different heights over the Santa Rosa Sound. To fake that, he'd have to have at least two people in two boats with models on top of rods, somehow 100 feet high and 130 feet away and many tens of feet above the water. Well, the bottom line is I studied all this stuff Ed was doing, and I concluded that it was Ed that didn't know how to do it. No, and the stereo photos, you couldn't even read it in a book about how to create stereo photos like he did by taking pictures. Bottom line is I was convinced by all the hard evidence that he had done this, and of course the fact that there were other witnesses who claimed they saw the same thing didn't hurt at all in terms of my interpretation of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
sightings continued all the way through 1989 and 90, and then in 90, we started getting these so-called Red Bubba sightings, which is another wrinkle on the Gulf Breeze phenomenon, which they're so coming so often that news organizations would go there and very often have their own sightings. And Ed had sporadic sightings in the years up through 1997. We wrote a book called UFOs Are Real, Here's the Proof, which is a paperback book and outlines virtually everything that happened after the first burst of sightings.
Mm-hmm. There's some questions up on that. Now, I know that I read, you know, a bit about that particular, you know, the Gulf Breeze in general, and, you know, a lot of people were claiming that they're, that Ed's pictures were hoaxed. There's some neighborhood kids that claim they helped him do some hoaxing, and there's, you know, of course, the model they found under the insulation in the attic and all that. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot that makes Ed's pictures questionable, but you still think they're authentic.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I might point out that I really have two Gulf Breeze sightings in the book, or more than two sightings. But there's, I think, six sightings on November 11, 1987, and I just sort of obliquely refer to the rest of the sightings. I don't really have time to go into all the stuff in this book. This book is not about the Gulf Breeze sightings anyway. It's about the CIA.
Sure. Yeah, I know. We're a little
bit of another. I gave another. The last sighting in the book is a real puzzler, and it has to do with a remaining magnetic effect after a UFO was sighted. It has nothing to do with Ed, but it happened in Gulf Breeze. It's a very interesting sighting from the point of view of a physicist who knows that wood is not magnetic, and yet. What appeared to be in the treetops was a huge magnetic field. And the reason it is interesting from the point of view of the physicist is the guy who detected the field was using a gradient magnetometer, which is a scientific instrument for a scientifically based device or instrument used for detecting big chunks of steel underground primarily. The person who has used it and found this magnetic field out behind his house was very well accustomed to finding oil well heads, that is, oil well casings, big steel pipe that's driven down into the ground. And sometimes they would be driven down into the ground and covered up, and you have to come back later on and find out where the well head was by using a gradient magnetometer or some other device that is sensitive to the distortion of this magnetic field by big chunks of metal. And two of the MUFON investigators, well, first of all, there's a sighting that occurred by the guy's wife on a Friday night. She's driving home. She sees coming up from behind her house a standard Model A flying saucer disc with dome on it that goes upwards, turns to the right sort of from her perspective, does a flip over and disappears in the air. She told her husband when he came back that night. He called the MUFON investigators, and they said they'd be there the next day. The next morning, he just started to walk out and see if there was a magnetic field available, associated with anything in his backyard where there was a pond. The reason he suspected that there might be a magnetic field was because many years earlier, he had had an object fly right over his car. And he said the gauges on the car were screwed up. And he thought that at the time that it was because a big magnetic field had screwed up the gauges in his car. Well, he had no way of measuring a magnetic field back at that time. But now, in 1992, he had a gradient magnetometer that could easily measure a magnetic field. He started walking around his backyard. He walked around this pond. And sure enough, detected a region where there was a big magnetic field. Problem. There was nothing there that was iron. No, there was no possibility of a magnetic field from the conventional physics point of view, and yet his instrument showed it. And when the MUFON investigators got there in the afternoon, they videotaped him waving his wand around as he walked around the pond looking for sources of magnetic field. And the interesting thing is his gradient magnetometer generated a sound, a noise, a frequency. The pitch of the frequency would go up in presence of a piece of metal. And the bigger, the higher the frequency, the bigger the magnetic field gradient. And he got a huge frequency, a huge gradient, when he stood underneath some pine trees and pointed his rod straight up. There shouldn't have been anything there. There's no physics explanation for this. Yet there's no denying that it was there because it was recorded on the video. The pitch was, you can hear the high frequency being generated by the instrument is recorded on the audio on the video camera. And I was able to calibrate his gradiometer with a magnet of known strength and determine that, well, when I told a guy where I worked, who was into submarines or magnetic fields, how much pitch change there was or what the gradient field was, he told me it was like standing about 20 meters away from a destroyer-sized battleship. Talk about a big chunk of iron. Shit. And yet there was no iron there at all.
Unbelievable. Hey, you know, we only have, the time just seems to really fly here. We have a number of questions. We have only about 5 minutes left. But just, you know, and I'm just going to ask this question real quickly, and then I promise you we won't talk about the Gulf Breeze anymore. But this question's up here. It says that you never talked about Ed Walters being an ex-convict who spent several years in Florida prison for multiple crimes. Don't you think that such a background is relevant to the question of his character? And just answer that quickly, and then we'll move on, because I have another.
I don't know where the questioner got that. Ed was a bad boy when he was 19. When he was 40, he was given a pardon for all the good work he had done.
Okay, so let's not hang on that. I want to ask you quickly, are you familiar with whether it exists or not, the TR-3B, the black triangle they say is anti-gravity? Are you familiar with have you done any looking into that at all?
No, I have not. I know people making claims about it, but I have not investigated it myself.
Yeah, okay. And let's see. I just wanted to get back, to other questions. We had a number of people in the chat room. The question that comes to mind is, you know, you always hear, and there's plenty of evidence out there, in my opinion, that the government, or at least some part of the government, is covering up certain things like Roswell and all that. Do you have in mind that there's some, almost like MJ-12, I don't want to get into that because I'm not really sure what I think about that, but do you think there is some type of MJ-12 where there's people from each three-letter acronym that are involved in some type of cover-up, or do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, let me say that I make the argument for a cover-up without using any MJ-12 or Roswell and whatever. If you take Roswell and MJ-12 and so on away, you still can show that there was a cover-up based on the available, undisputedly real, verifiable documents. That's my argument in the book. Mm-hmm. And it's not something you can summarize just in a few sentences. You got to read how things developed over several years from 1947 until 1952.
Right, right.
Do I believe there's a circuit group? Yeah, I think there is. It's not overt, semi-overtly available, as I found out from investigating the CIA. Even one CIA guy thought there was something really going on so deep that he couldn't get to it.
Wow. Wow. Just if you can say this in less than a minute, what is the most compelling picture? Is it the McMinnville that you've researched?
The most compelling what?
Image.
Most compelling image? Well, I guess the Trent case, there's no doubt, as I said, in the Trent case, it's either a real thing or a hoax. And I certainly investigated that. some of the images in the New Zealand film from December of 1978 are impossible to explain by conventional means. More recently, in the copper mine in Chile, Kawalasi or something like that, that Leslie Kane has written about recently, shows something that was up in the sky that the miners took photographs of, and that looks very interesting, somewhat like the Trinidad photo.
Now, Bruce, can you quickly say the title of your book, and you can find it right on Amazon?
You can find it on Amazon. You can find it at Richard Dolan Press, richarddolanpress.com. The title is The FBI-CIA UFO Connection.
Very good. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And we'll have to have you on again sometime.
Let me just say my website.
Oh, yes, Brumac.
Brumac.8k.com. Brumac.8k.com. I just do a Google search on my name.
Very good. Okay, thank you, Bruce. Well, that's it for our show today. If you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, podcastufo.com. Our guest next week will be Brazilian UFO investigator A.J. Gravard. And I want to thank everyone for helping out today. Of course, Bruce Maccabee, Keith Rowland for the producer of the Dark Matter Radio Network, Alejandro Rojas for the latest news, Kerry Lloyd at White House for our music, Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. Remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. You can check us out next week right here live on the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And hope to see you in the chat room. Thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, keep your eyes to the sky.